Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
2 years into this financial crisis, the whole thing seems to have come down to a case of, yes, you did, oh, no, I didn't. The chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States found himself in an unusual position today, denying he used some muscle to force Bank of America to buy Merrill Lynch. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by ConAgra Foods, the people behind brands like Orville Redenbacher's, Chef Boyardee, and Healthy Choice. More at conagrafoods.com. And by Super Brands, Brand Week's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brand Week Super Brands for more information.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. It is the 25th of June today. This happens all the time when witnesses testify before Congress.
Will you please stand and raise your right hand?
But still, when Ben Bernanke rose to be sworn in this morning by the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, it was a little jarring. The Fed chairman was grilled, and I use that word intentionally, about the Fed's role in the Bank of America Merrill Lynch deal from late last year. Not long after that takeover was announced, it became clear Bank of America would be taking on a company in bad shape and getting worse. There's been talk ever since that Ben Bernanke and then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson strong-armed B of A CEO Ken Lewis into closing the deal. And a couple of weeks ago, Lewis told the committee that his job had indeed been threatened if he backed out. Today, it was Bernanke's turn in the witness chair, and Tamara Keith tells us from Washington that Mr. Bernanke said his hands, well, they're clean.
The first question came from the committee chairman, New York Democrat Adolphus Towns. It wasn't a softball.
Did you instruct Hank Paulson to tell Ken Lewis that he and his board would be fired if they backed out of the Merrill deal?
That would be Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson. Fed Chairman Bernanke made what would be the first of many denials.
I did not instruct Mr. Paulson or anyone else to convey such a threat or message to Mr. Lewis.
Republican Dan Burton read from an email a regional Fed president sent at the time Bank of America was threatening to pull out of the deal. The official had just talked with Bernanke, who he said
also intends to make it even more clear that if they play that card, and then need assistance, management is gone. You didn't say anything like that?
I don't know if I did or not.
Burton said he's been on this investigative committee a long time and has heard plenty of people give answers like that.
In order to keep people from perjuring themselves, they couldn't remember anything. Are you sure you can't remember?
I'm sure I can't remember.
The committee still wants to hear from Paulson, now a former Treasury Secretary, and others. For his part, Ben Bernanke said he doesn't regret anything about the whole transaction. He said it protected the economy, and at a time when the financial system was hanging on by a thread. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
You remember that big push for change from a certain presidential campaign last year? We learned today the financial services industry is out for a little change of its own. It has launched a publicity campaign to fight back against what it sees as unfair criticism. Bloomberg News reports today that the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, that's one of Wall Street's biggest lobbying groups, is pushing the image revamp, and it's spending nearly $85,000 a month to win back the good graces of the outside world. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
The association asked pollsters to gauge the public mood. What they found wasn't pretty. Cornell Belcher runs Brilliant Corners Research, a polling company. He worked on the Obama campaign and was hired by SIFMA to help it embrace change.
It is part of this new patriotism that's sweeping this country, where corporations need to be held to a higher standard as well. You know, you've got to be a good corporate citizen. You've got to be a corporate patriot in this environment, or the consumers are going to punish you.
Rather than conducting a high-profile media blitz, SIFMA is taking a grassroots approach. The group is using lesser-known, untainted regional financial firms to get its message to Congress via local politicians. A large part of that message is that the securities industry has its own reform ideas. Dan Simon is managing director at Cognito, a PR company for the financial services industry. He says the industry could have acted much faster to protect its image.
Actually being ahead of regulators, or being at least being seen to be ahead of kind of public sentiment, is absolutely crucial.
SIFMA recently announced its own recommendations on executive pay.
Hugh Johnson is chief economist at Johnson Illington Advisors. He says Congress has been passing reforms as fast as a speeding train. The securities industry is on a PR push to slow the regulatory reform express,
which has already left the station, and they want to become very much a part of shaping that regulation so that it doesn't go too far and do serious damage to Wall Street.
He says they know if they don't act, they risk being shunted aside. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketing is more important than ever in a down economy, and we ran across the latest example in the trade magazine Brand Week this morning. Pizza Hut seems to think that's just one word too many to be really catchy. The Hut, they say, would be better. Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports it's yet another fast food chain trying to change with the times.
Outside a Pizza Hut in downtown L.A. this morning, I asked passerby a pretty obvious question.
So when you think of Pizza Hut, what food item comes to mind?
I think a very spongy pizza, barely edible.
Greasy pizza.
Setting aside these guys' unsolicited editorializing, you'd think this would make the folks running Pizza Hut happy, because at least customers know what they sell, right? But problem is, more and more consumers aren't buying pizza from chains, like this guy.
I actually bought a frozen French bread with pizza toppings on top of it last night.
Marissa Gluck is a marketing consultant with Radar Research.
Pizza Hut is suffering in the recession. People are opting for frozen pizzas.
And those frozen grocery store pizzas are generally tastier than the cheesy cardboard you may remember from youth. So with the Hut campaign, says Gluck, Pizza Hut is trying to step away from pizza and remind folks they sell other stuff, like pasta. They're not the first fast food chain to try this.
A few years ago, you had Kentucky Fried Chicken changing to KFC so that people wouldn't associate KFC necessarily with fried chicken.
But Gluck doesn't think it fooled anyone. And she says messing with your brand name can potentially do more harm than good.
We've already seen that it's confused marketing experts who have written about Pizza Hut is changing their name. They say they're not changing their name. I can only imagine how confusing it would be to consumers.
From the downtown L.A. Chicken Wing Hut, Pasta Hut, Hut, which sells food. I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders took back what they gave away earlier this week. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Whether or not you subscribe to the belief that the worst of the credit crisis is behind us, that is, that the banking system is actually getting healthier, there are other parts of the credit economy out there worth keeping an eye on. Personal credit, specifically. Car loans, credit cards, student loans, that kind of thing. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that the lousy labor market could wind up bringing us credit crisis part two.
Not only are more people unemployed, more people are staying unemployed. The number of people running out of unemployment benefits is at its highest level in decades, and that's going to deal another blow to the economy, mounting credit card defaults. David Robertson is the publisher of the Nielsen Report, an industry newsletter.
When that paycheck goes away, decisions have to be made. Mortgages, car loans, etc., and the credit card bill is mostly the one that goes by first.
Credit card defaults have hit record highs. This year, the industry is expected to lose around $80 billion. Still, economist Greg McBride says credit card debt will not be the new mortgage debt.
The numbers are much, much smaller. The implication of defaults on the broader economy, isn't something that really even belongs in the same conversation as what we've seen in the mortgage side.
We owe about $1 trillion on our cards. Compare that to the roughly $11 trillion we owe on our mortgages. But those numbers don't tell the whole story, says Robert Manning, founder of the Responsible Debt Relief Program. He says these days people are using their cards for rent and food. So when they start missing card payments, it's a sign they're slipping over the edge.
While the outstanding amount of credit card debt sounds very small compared to mortgage debt, it's going to expose all these other trillions of dollars in consumer debt that people may have to default on.
Manning expects a flood of personal bankruptcies this year, and he says that could have devastating effects throughout the economy. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Lennar Holmes reported a surprise jump in orders for new houses this morning. That, in part, helped Wall Street look on the bright side of life today. The other side of the real estate market, though, is still dark and really gloomy, the part with foreclosures, subprime loans, and houses going unsold for months at a time. A lot of subprime borrowers lost their homes a year ago or more. But now, thanks to rising unemployment and falling household incomes, people with good credit and plain old vanilla loans are defaulting. And that is spreading the real estate bust all over the place, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
South Carolina realtor Jerry Prudhomme is showing us around his own slice of real estate heaven, the exclusive Forest Beach neighborhood on Hilton Head Island.
Now we're heading down one of the streets. This is called Sandpiper. If you look down these streets, you can see the ocean.
Or maybe we should call it Prudhomme's real estate hell.
This is a property that was foreclosed on several months ago.
Prudhomme says these luxury homes have had much of their value washed away over the last few years.
This house was originally listed for over $3 million, and the bank is now offering this house for $979,000.
The people who bought these homes weren't deadbeats. They had good credit and money in the bank, but many of them fell into the same traps that subprime borrowers did, taking out huge loans with exotic names like Alt-A and Option Arm. John Taylor heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He's been tracking the mortgage crisis. He says in some cases, borrowers didn't have to disclose their income to lenders, so they didn't. They got low initial interest rates.
At some point, that interest rate was going to change, or they're going to have to pay the full interest and principal amount. And at that point, you're looking at a loan that was not sustainable and not a prime loan, but actually a quite expensive loan for the people given the income that they had.
They're starting to reset at the exact point where the unemployment rate is rising.
Patrick Newport is an economist with IHS Global Insight. He says all over America, people are losing jobs and income as the economy sputters. Homeowners with adjustable rate mortgages are stuck. They can't refinance because they owe more than their houses are worth.
We're going to see another wave of foreclosures on top of what we're seeing right now. And what it means is that the foreclosure problem is going to be with us for quite a while.
Newport says he's most worried about prime borrowers. As job losses mount, they're defaulting at a record pace. These are people who didn't do anything risky when they bought their houses. They got standard fixed-rate mortgages with reasonable interest rates and affordable monthly payments. They're people like Mark Remington. He owns a landscape design business in the small town of Valdez, North Carolina, but nobody's building these days, and he's hurting bad. He has to pay $1,800 a month to service his mortgage and home equity loan. He's had to dig deep into his savings, and he's running out of options.
What I've done is rather than not make the payment and just stick my head in the sand and run the other way, I've tried to make good faith payments of $500 a month towards the mortgage. And it doesn't matter what you have your mortgage at. If there's no work out there to pay your bills, it just becomes a non-issue.
On Hilton Head Island, 300 miles to the south, Jerry Prudhomme's well-heeled clients are heading down a similar path.
And we're seeing people who have been real estate investors as well as investors in equities for many, many years who have never missed a mortgage payment who now are missing their first mortgage payment. You know, we haven't seen the crest of the wave yet, but it is certainly on its way.
If the economy continues to falter, that'll mean more job losses and more foreclosures. Prudhomme thinks in his area, with loan resets in the mix, home prices could keep spiraling downward for the next 3 years at least. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, India before the boom.
The main thing to understand about India is it's such a diverse and such a complex culture that Indians are very often strangers to some aspect of their own country.
But first, let's do the numbers. Ben Bernanke wasn't just on the defensive today. He also had some uplifting words on the economy, and that helped. The Dow Industrials raced up 172 points, more than 2%, closed at 8,472. The NASDAQ caught the same elevator. It posted a gain of 37 points, around 2%, to finish at 1,829. The S&P 500 climbed 19 points, more than 2%, broke the tape at 920. We told you about Lennar Homes. KB Home and Pulte Home also raised the roof, closing up about 8 and 6% respectively. All that new square footage, of course, needs sinks and light fixtures and all the rest. Investors rushed the welcome mat at Home Depot. Shares there closed nearly 4% higher. Meantime, retailer Bed Bath & Beyond reported profits that went beyond expectations. That got investors up and on their feet. Shares rose nearly 10% there. The market gave Microsoft a nod, too. The software giant is hoping to boost slumping sales by cutting the price on its Windows 7 system. Stock logged in gains of 1.3% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, President Obama meets with German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the White House. The monthly report on personal income and spending is released. The Commerce Department lets us know how much money we pocketed and how much left our wallet in May. And it's the United Nations International Day in support of victims of torture. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The world's 17 largest economies have been meeting outside Mexico City this week to talk climate change. They're trying to lay the groundwork for a much bigger conference to be held later this year in Denmark. These meetings involve a lot of the standard talk of cutting greenhouse gas emissions in half by some date in the medium-term future. But scientists are warning that even the most ambitious cuts aren't going to be enough to stop the effects of global warming. So attention is shifting now to figuring out how to adapt to it instead. For a growing number of businesses and investors, that spells opportunity, as Sam Eaton reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Most talk about adapting to a warmer world usually involves protecting coastal areas from rising seas, but it also means ensuring access to some of the most basic elements of human survival, starting with fresh water. That was the topic on everyone's mind at a recent trade show in San Diego.
We see climate change as a water problem.
Paul Schuler is with General Electric's Water Technologies Unit. He's manning a booth showcasing the company's water-saving applications.
Whether it's Australia now with the droughts, even Georgia has a drought, West Coast, water scarcity and water location is the problem here in the future.
And Schuler says GE wants to ensure that its products, everything from systems that recycle wastewater to high-tech purifiers, are the go-to technologies for drought-prone regions.
In all honesty, it's a money-making strategy, but you can do the right thing and you can make money. They're not mutually exclusive.
And with talk of establishing an international adaptation fund as part of the next UN climate treaty, GE's money-making strategy could pay off. The UN fund would ensure billions of dollars in financing for water, agriculture, and infrastructure projects in poor nations. And if businesses with a technical know-how are already lining up, institutional investors are close behind.
People who are investing in adaptation now see an opportunity where there wasn't one before.
Matt Mascardi is with the Green Investment Coalition Ceres.
You're dealing with loss of land because of potential floods. You're dealing with drought and possible famine. You're dealing with infectious diseases on the rise.
And with each of these consequences comes the potential for vast new markets. Mark Fulton is Deutsche Bank's chief climate change strategist. He says the bank's $4 billion climate fund mostly invests in renewables and energy efficiency, technologies aimed at curbing global warming. But as greenhouse gas emissions continue unabated, Deutsche Bank is shifting more of those funds into adaptation technologies.
Irrigation, fertilizers, mechanization in food. In water, you've got desalination, you've got filtration, reverse osmosis.
Global banking giant HSBC also invests in adaptation. And South Korean firm Daishin plans to launch a climate commodities fund later this year. Its profits derive from bets against future food shortages and diminishing natural resources. Matt Mascardi with Ceres says these investments may signal a new trend, but they're far from the norm.
Investors are just now realizing that there's investment opportunity in renewable energies and climate mitigation. And adaptation lags even further behind that.
Just look at Deutsche Bank. Mark Fulton says climate investments there, both for mitigation and adaptation, account for less than 1% of Deutsche Bank's $600 billion portfolio. And that's at a bank with one of the most aggressive climate change policies in the world. Fulton says it's a worrying sign.
Because if the scientists are anywhere near right, then if we don't get to scale, and that requires hundreds of billions of dollars a year to be spent on these sectors, really, then, you know, if they're right, we've got some big problems coming.
Problems in need of big solutions, not to mention a little foresight, something Randy Scherson knows firsthand. He's passing out flyers for his engineering company at the San Diego trade show. But back in 2005, he was a relief worker in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and he saw what it means to be unprepared.
Unfortunately, the way the situation usually happens is we wait until the disaster's already taken place, and then there's a big mad rush to buy and purchase emergency equipment.
Scherson's company, Goodman Ball, has one solution. It makes a portable water purifier that fits on the back of a pickup truck. It's designed to provide clean drinking water during natural disasters. And Scherson says orders have been on the rise. In San Diego, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The global economy looks pretty bleak right now, but there are a couple of exceptions. India is one of them. The World Bank says the Indian economy could grow by as much as 8% next year. That economy has been the backdrop for the stories of novelist Aravind Adiga. His first book, The White Tiger, was set in the 1990s, when tech startups and international trade helped India really join the global economy. His latest book, a series of short stories called Between the Assassinations, goes back a couple of years earlier to a time when things weren't really so robust. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
The two assassinations in the title of your book, 1984 and Indira Gandhi and 1991 and Rajiv Gandhi's assassination. Why those two events as the sort of brackets of this time?
Well, first of all, I was born in 1974, and the first sort of political event I remember was the assassination of the Prime Minister in 1984. But this event was kind of important in another way, because Indira Gandhi had been one of the creators of India, and she had increased the degree of centralized control over the Indian economy to an extraordinary extent while she had been in charge. So that by 1984, India was a very centralized economy that was closed off to the world. We didn't have Coca-Cola in India, for instance. It was banned. And when she died, there was great national trauma, but also the prospect of an opening up of that economy. And her son, who became prime minister after her, promised that he would install this new India. And this was Rajiv Gandhi, but he failed to do so. And it was only after his death in 1991 that India finally opened up to the world.
But it's interesting because the characters in this book, between 84 and 91, they are, many of them, ambitious and striving. They really want more than they can have at that instant.
Yes, because this was a fact of life in the 1980s in India, I think, which is India has always been open to information from outside. So we had the New York Times, we had the BBC, we had information coming from the world outside, and we knew there was so much out there. But the world we lived in was a closed-off, socialist world with very limited economic opportunities for us. And this created a great deal of tension that is recorded in this book.
This town that you created this book around, Kittur, it's a figment of your imagination, obviously, but it must somehow represent all of India for you, no?
Yes, that's right. It was meant to be a microcosm of India in some way, a typical portrait of a small Indian town. The India I grew up in was the small-town India, which tends not to get much represented either in cinema or in literature. But if you were a small-town boy from the south of India, as I was, you would be puzzled by this idea that India was full of very rich or very poor people, because you wouldn't see either around you. No one was really rich. But certainly you wouldn't see slums, or you wouldn't see large masses of poor people either.
Do those small towns play a big part in the Indian economy today?
They are. This is the interesting fact. That is, they in a sense hold the key to India's future, because one of the odd things about India is, unlike China, India has had a very low level of urbanization. Something like 60% of Indians, or even, perhaps even more, still live in villages. And the reason is, there's often no work in the big cities, nor is there anywhere for you to live. And so this creates large slums in the big cities. And for years, economists have thought that the way to fix this problem has been to encourage the development of smaller towns in India. But you need a government that's conscious of this. The development of these kind of smaller urban centers is really the key to a sustainable future for India.
Do the differences in the Indian economic landscape between the big cities and the smaller towns you're talking about, how does that inform and affect your writing?
I left India from a small town and I came to university in the United States. And when I went back to India, I went back to Delhi, and now I live in Mumbai. And for the first time, I lived in bigger cities. And in a sense, I'm much more conscious of how different the cities are from the towns I grew up in, because, the economic disparities are so much harsher in the cities. But also there's a greater sense of excitement of the possibility of change. The main thing to understand about India is it's such a diverse and such a complex culture that Indians are very often strangers to some aspect of their own country. It once again reminds you that India is something fascinating and exciting and something that comes alive.
The most recent book by Arvind Adiga is called Between the Assassinations. Arvind, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
I asked him what his favorite part of his new book was. To hear his answer and to read an excerpt of it, visit our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today about a poster. A poster from 33 years ago that had pride of place on my bedroom wall when I was a kid. Farrah Fawcett died this morning. She was 62 years old. In 1976, that poster of her went on sale. You know the one I'm talking about, probably, with the bathing suit and the hair and the teeth. We called around today. Three different companies claim the copyright on that picture, but consensus seems to be about 12 million copies of it sold, one of them to the Smithsonian Institution. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 172 points, more than 2%. The Nasdaq gained 37 points, about 0.2%. The S&P 500 hiked up 19 points, more than 2% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, when games can help brighten the recession blues.
You can have a Xbox 360, HD, Elite, blah, 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 but you break out a pack of Uno, and the response far trumps the Xbox 360.
Probably depends on the crowd, I'd say. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.